All right. Good morning, May 4th, 2022. We are coming to you live from Belgrade, Serbia, former Yugoslavia. People still say that, former Yugoslavia. How much of a former entity will Ukraine be when we talk about the former Ukraine, which I first introduced the term. I was the one to coin the term, if I can take credit for that one, for calling it the former Ukraine. I think I started it, I mean, not totally in jest, but kind of egging it on back at the end of February. We started talking about the former Ukraine. And now when we look at all the pieces of the former Ukraine, it's interesting to see these multiple conflicting narratives, right? Because you have this one narrative that the Russian front is about to collapse at any moment. And this was introduced on February 25th, that Russia only has a week of logistical support or something like this. So then it turned out that it was Germany that only had 4 days worth of ammunition. Like, a lot of this German problem with munitions has revealed that it's actually Germany. But that's not, you know, that's where NATO has wanted Germany to be for reasons we understand. There is some idea that if Germany had an independent military presence in Europe, that Europe would have a more independent foreign policy. Or is that appropriate to speak of the EU having a foreign policy? Or do all the relations that the different EU member states have, are those the foreign policies of all the EU member states? Well, I'm not against the idea of a European Union, either economically or militarily. But of course, the details make it a problem. So when we look at, first to begin, to jump in, the most recent published numbers on the armed forces of Ukraine that have our losses, this May 4th number as of May 4th is catastrophic. It's jumped up. You know, I want to say by 10,000 in just, I mean, it's at some 50,000 and something. It's real bad. These are fairly, well, these are really good numbers. These are all based upon the daily numbers, which mention them from the Russian Ministry of Defense. These are from the daily numbers that the MOD mentions, but doesn't produce a single graphic sheet for. So this is not produced by, but it's all these numbers are the ones that when they report, for example, the MOD reported that during the day Ukrainian forces lost 493 people. Okay, that was 372 killed, 121 injured. So that was in the MOD report, right? But it wasn't added to some tally. But you can see these numbers. We're talking about the one that Rybar translates, or the Rybar puts out. you can see that they've gone over 50,000. When we look back, let's just look back to see if we can for a moment. The number, the last number that we put, we compared, April, from April 23rd, it was 39, we'll call it 40,000. If you add the other two categories, like National Guard and the other territorial defenses, it looks like you're at 44,000. So that's from April. Reasonably, yeah, it's 44,000 from April 23rd. And then you jump, you go to May 4th and you're at 50,000. So that's a week, 10 days, 5,000 losses. It looks like the numbers overall tend to be about 3 killed for 1 injured, which is not good. Very interesting by the numbers. Very, very interesting by the numbers. Very, very interesting by the numbers. How long can Ukraine continue with this? Well, when you look at the quality of some of the people who are captured, you know, maybe you could argue that people who look poorly equipped and particularly old, particularly not in the prime of their life, maybe they're just more prone to be captured. Maybe they're more prone to surrender. So there's always some potential bias in looking at these, some of these surrendered. But when you look at the large groups, yeah, you do get more. When you look at large groups of surrender all at once, it does seem to be that you get more variation on age and apparent health. So maybe that's how it works. I don't know. But I try to keep all these things in mind. It's very important to do when I'm assessing what looks like you know, what is Ukraine's potential in this conflict. They're losing between 300 and 500 people a day. That's a lot. Well, they've lost 5,000 in 10 days. They're losing. We are several months into this, say 2 months and some days. And they've lost 50,000. So that's about 25,000 a month. And of course, it's an error to like project that forward, like as if the tempo or the way what we've seen is what we'll see sort of thing, as if that's going to be consistent. That would be an error to assume, but it may be correct, that it may be correct in the final analysis. That may be correct. We just don't know at this time. Is that what's going to be projected outward? Russians have been hitting a lot of these fuel depots, a lot of critical infrastructure. This started a couple days ago, and we're seeing lots of these caliber strikes. It's a type of a cruise missile. We're seeing lots of them. Now, on the media front, maybe you've seen this, just to kind of reviewing what's been going on in this moment. In UK media, they're pretending that Putin has threatened to wipe the UK off the map with nuclear weapons. And this got, how they did it is, there's like I think on Rossiya 24, there was some documentary just about what are Russia's nuclear capabilities. And they're talking about nuclear armed submarines, and that the UK would be wiped off the planet pretty quickly, would be plunged under the sea, is the quote that the UK Independent is pulling out. And they're trying to connect it to Putin by saying that the guy who was like the spokesperson or the presenter in this TV documentary is a Putin propagandist. Dmitry Kiselyov, a Putin propagandist, threatened the UK with a Poseidon underwater drone. It must be like an unmanned submarine. I don't know how that device functions, but apparently it goes boom in a very big way and it kills everybody. So that's the same thing as having made the threat. I'm not going to point out hypocrisies or silliness of that. You can make all those inferences yourself. It's pretty ridiculous, though. But it reminds people that there's a conflict. And I wonder sometimes when these things air in Russia, they have their own internal reasons, but they know that this is going to get picked up. How does that affect people's thinking? I sort of have this suspicion that young people, like fighting age young, haven't been exposed enough to the nuclear threat. They've been more exposed to the maybe like the bogged down in Middle East or bogged down in Afghanistan thing. They've sort of been thinking about wars of wasting money and staying a long time on a long mission. So they're thinking about war in terms of its expense or duration. Probably some people, in terms of, war crimes or things like this, and are thoughtful people about it. But is there a lot of thinking about the fact that if this conflict escalates to where Russia feels, because it's not a person, we always warn against talking about international relations like personalities, right? But where Russian leadership assesses that the threat is existential. Is an existential threat, is, how about this one? Is Poland going in to Western Ukraine an existential threat? Who keeps floating that? Is this getting floated a lot in Western media? It gets talked about in Poland, but are you hearing about this more from sort of like how we talk about Russian media, or from if you're following different Russian channels, maybe on Telegram? Is this coming more through there, or is this coming right? So where is this coming from? That doesn't mean who's behind it. It's just who's amplifying. And that could be, biased to where you're getting your information from. But generally speaking, you're hearing about a lot of this. You're hearing about this from Russian sources. And the Russians are, and we talked about this. I mean, you know, it's, look, I don't have a PR agent or anybody. So I have to kind of, like, when I call something, I have to remind them, like, hey, and I'm the one who said it, right? I mean, you know, because who else is going to do that for me? But why we're here, sometimes once in a while, the things that I talk about have value. I said, like in March 5th or something like this, we went all about Poland. How could Poland come up on top? And what do I mean by that? Well, so all the countries that want to show that they can flex are trying to increase their territory, like a little bit. Think about countries right now are trying to flex that they can add some territory, and that whole concept is strictly verboten by the rules of the international law. I mean, there are ways that international law has developed and been interpreted because it's more of a more determined by precedents and common law. International law is by past practices that have become codified and sort of ritualized or normalized through precedent. Normally, a country cannot territorially, you know, grow, right? And now, of course, you can do that by proxies, and those are all within the rubric of questionable ways, or ways that maybe there's some historical precedent for, or you can argue. But Russia did this with Georgia. Now, the details and the history of these, of course, are going to be unique, and every country has its claims to these things. And we're not here to discuss, you know, who are the people and what did they want to live and how was the arrangement done and how was the relationship with Georgia when it was part of the Soviet Union and things like this, when it was the Georgian SSR. How those things kind of left strange borders and unstable political outcomes. Well, that's what we're seeing in Ukraine. But Russia really flexed hard when it did that. You can almost talk about this 2008 period as being a new chapter. That's when the information war, that's when basically within those couple years, like 2006, 2008, that's when RT took off. That's when Iran did Press TV. And then shortly thereafter, the Chavismo, the Bolivarians out of Venezuela, not to be confused with the Bolivarians of Bolivia, and not to be confused with Simon Bolivar, who might not have agreed with either. They launched the Telesur. And, but it's, you can see how all these took off. Now, Turkey has TRT, has Turkey Today, has Turkish World. Okay. Now, what they've effectively done in Syria with Turkmen, with Syrian Turkmen, they're not leaving. Anything that Turkey picked up, it's not going to it's too important. You could tell that the Western parliamentary transactional financial system and globalization was weakening when we started to see a return to a practice of about 90 years ago, where you have presidents for life or for a very long time. You had in the States, you had FDR for a dozen years. You had in the Soviet Union at the time, you had Stalin. Italy had Mussolini. Germany had Hitler. Think about, you have in India, you have Modi. In China, you have XJP. Russia has Putin. The Germans, for a long time, had Merkel. That was a sign of stability. But within, I mean, if you really deconstruct the forces behind her, things that when she declared multiculturalism a failure, things like this, this goes back some time. None of these people, none of these things are one-dimensional. Nor do they, it's not as simple as they're just a puppet of so-and-so or just a puppet of something-something. So the biggest flex is to add territory. The United States would like to do something like this just to show. It's not going to do anything more than maybe like with Puerto Rico. And that could cause extreme, just that tiny amount of changing Puerto Rico, because it would give senators and things, would create such imbalance to the political conflict already inside the United States. It would be, I think, unmanageable. Or the way, I mean, you know, life goes on, right? You can steamroll it. I mean, you can say, oh, look, we managed it, but the consequences would be very bad. So you can look at the story of Poland when you go back 200 and 300 years. In the sort of the literature, there's this idea, especially keeping in mind that Russia was smaller before. I mean, not in the 20th century, but in the 17th century, prior to a lot of territory picked up. That was Tartaria or Turania and Ottoman lands. You had this duel between Poland and Russia, and it continued on. I mean, Moscow has been ruled by Poles before. Poland has built up, we talked about, in its educational systems and its history approach, a very strong nationalism. I know that there has been work for a long time between the Ukraine Nazis, far-right Nazis in Ukraine, to speak a common language with the Polish nationalists. more broadly, this is the Visegrad group, or the even more broadly, the Intermarium project of Middle Europa, this concept of Middle Europa, or the Baltic to Black Sea. So when this all, obviously everything comes together, an extra impetus for Russia in its campaign right now to close off the Black Sea is so that, in other words, for Mykolaiv and Odessa regions to be part of a Novorossiya, if you will, it's now, if that's Russia, and if the Black Sea is cut off, then they need to basically include Romania, Moldova, or something into this. But that's been a dream, and we've dissected this one before, and a lot of neocon people, I guess you would say Donald Rumsfeld and others, going back to the Bush administration, they had been talking about, really for a long time, this concept of New Europe, and they had been pursuing false promises for the whole region. What do I mean by this? Well, it's pretty clear. Look at the false promises that NATO and the Western powers gave to Ukraine. And that's military. That's defense. This was supposed to be, we're going to be all in with you, and when there's no way that we can let you lose to Russia in Ukraine. And look at what happened. Look at the size of Ukraine today. Ukraine knows that it's not getting, on a certain level, like the people who actually think in leadership, despite that they're subordinate. I mean, just within their own minds, what they know is going on. Just in terms of what they know is going on. They know. They know now that Kherson is never going back. How can you know, we've talked a lot about the peace talks, and we haven't always given the Ukrainian side of the bargaining table the fairest shake. I think we have given them a fair shake, given that they're not in control of their own positions. But just imagine for a moment that they were. Could any political leadership that has to be popular and get elected again and not have a coup or have generals or the SBU, just imagine it's a sovereign state, right? Could the civilian government really get into an agreement with Russia that Crimea, Donetsk, and Lugansk are gone forever? That these are just parts of Russia now? Considering that at the beginning, they only had to recognize Crimea. Do you know that Donetsk and Lugansk were supposed to stay inside of Ukraine? All they needed was to change the laws in probably change the constitution a little bit, like maybe, let's say, for example, back to how it was before Victoria Nuland's people changed it, or before they began to do things that require referendums without a referendum. Ukraine couldn't make that decision for themselves even then to recognize, to cut their losses with Crimea, and to just have the Donetsk and Lugansk be, you know, they could have been autonomous, but the federal authorities, like Ukrainian federal, or not federal, but the central authorities of the unitary state from Kiev could have had control over the border. It could have been the Ukrainian army under Kiev control that actually ran the border between Donetsk, Lugansk on the Ukrainian side, and let's say the nearest Russian road to town, you know, in Russia, Rostov on Don or something like this. They could have controlled that border on that road, on all those roads, if they had followed Minsk II agreement. It was actually going to remain part of Ukraine, but just be effectively more like how things were before, let's say, like 2004. And definitely before 2014. Okay. So, but Russia picked up these pieces. At this point in time, then, for Poland to do some kind of flex where they pick up territory, I think this actually does a couple of things. I think it emboldens the leadership on the one hand, but it also gives a sense of success to people, and it can give a sense, a release of pent-up pressures. And if Poland could take these parts of Ukraine, it would need to do so in such a way that internal Polish media hyper-focused on the war crimes and crimes against humanity of the Nazis and Bandera. But of course, they will also include some anti-Soviet, anti-Russian things in there and just call it all extremism. But in terms of justifying their presence over time, if they do go into Western Ukraine, which they've been biting at the chomps, right? We've been talking about this. It's like we've been talking about this for how long? Since the start of this conflict. It's almost like we've had this Azovstal story. We've had the fight around Slavyansk, beyond a city of Donetsk, Slavyansk and Izium. You know, the fights in the Donbass, in the main area between, or the areas all around Lugansk and Donetsk, Kharkov, all the big fighting there. That's been a major feature. And that's been, and then we've had this, these strikes that hit either Odessa or somewhere around Western Ukraine, right? These are this is the story that we've been juggling back and forth as we every day look, okay, what's going on, right? And this idea that Poland, it wants to get in there is so complex, so many levels and so many layers to this. I've said that Russia and Poland would have to use some of that special Slavic nonverbal communication, but the Catholic faith kind of interferes with the telepathy. It kind of messes up with the Slavic psyche. Like there's some strange incompatibility between the hardware of being Slav and the software of being Catholic. It just doesn't work together very well in the end. There's not a good model of how to be Catholic and Slavic. It can interfere with the intuition, but if Poland and Russia are to conclude that deal, it would be expressed through the language of reading signs, how to read Russian signs, how to read the things that they propose. So much of the warning about it has come from the Russian side that it makes me think they're not happy about it, or they think it's inevitable, but they want the question to be situated a certain way. They know how much Ukrainians are paying attention to what Russia says. Even they pay more attention to what Russia says than what Poland says. So if Ukrainians pay attention to what Russia says and Russia keeps talking about Poland's going to go in, are the Pravi sector and Idar, I would say Azov, but they don't really exist much as a force anymore, do they? But are the rest of the guys going to be down with that? It doesn't matter if people like Duda go up there and talk about, we love Ukraine, we're going to have no border. I mean, that's just basic intermarium talk. That's like a special visa regime. If they want to do something with Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, you know, there's always been this talk to increase the economic and communication and transportation abilities between these countries as part of the Baltic Sea to Black Sea corridor. It's sort of a geopolitical theory, but a real effort. And as we said, it's full of many false promises. This was what Rumsfeld's plan for New Europe, what they called New Europe. But these numbers are catastrophic. I would expect that when Russia publishes its numbers again, that they're at 8,000. I don't know if they've published them recently, but that's my intuition, is that Russian losses, I think dead, are going to be at 8,000 to 6,000 to 8,000, and injured quite a bit more, maybe up to 10,000 or 9,000 altogether. That's the number that I think. It could be, let's see, 12. I just think that the decisive air superiority and how they've been doing how they've been conducting the fight, using a lot of second generational warfare methods. We've talked about long range artillery and then having infantry go in to occupy the place that was shelled, or to clear up, or to pick off, or to swoop in. And there's different methods, of course, that could be used. We're not literally in the 18th or 19th century where second generation was in its, you know, infancy or prime, rather. But the fact that this method would be used makes sense. A typical artillery line, but then you would use more like third generation warfare, more broken up, smaller platoon type units go in to push the line or explore the line, mostly to check the reconnaissance, but also to push the line, to confirm what they thought was there, see what they did, and pull in and move the line. Move the whole line forward to catch all of the Ukrainian stragglers in an offsides trap, just like football. But it's been a long-held dream. Sold, you know, Polish young kids, young men in high school, and they love Poland. They're learning about every Polish king, and it's this ongoing fight with the Russians over sort of like who's the premier, who's the crown of the Slavic world. Poland was always very important country. The 20th century wasn't the most impressive century of Polish power, so we don't think of Poland, unless we're Poles and we know better, but we don't think of Poland as being a big power, but they historically have been. Linking up with Lithuania gave them a huge state. Very good traditions organizationally, militarily, very good traditions. I don't know how these been maintained, eroded. They've had a lot of interaction with NATO, of course. You need to do things towards NATO regulations so that you can work together as a force. But it's a real potential. It's a real thing. Poland has a lot of social economic problems and a lot of things that have been unpopular that they've had to do. And I know this sounds a little bit strange. Maybe at first it sounds counterintuitive, but if they had to deal with the Galician problem, and there's different ways they could deal with it. They could also pretend it's a non-problem. But how would they not go in and start to talk Poland if the Poles were in parts that were formerly Poland? How could they not be talking Poland while in former Poland? And how could they not be having problems with these Banderites? How could they not have problems with Banderites when they're there? How are they welcomed? How will they be viewed? How many Polish soldiers will go in? 10,000? Is it just to increase the human shield component to keep Russian calibers from striking critical infrastructure in Western Ukraine? What's the game? And while we've discussed all that in the last episodes, I've now got them, by the way, up on the drive from the weekend when we talked about this. This would be a big win for their army to be deployed in another country where that was once their own territory. And if they could prolong that and start to do the little games that we saw, the same thing with Turkey in the Turkmen part of Syria, that now they're permanently there. Overnight, they put little Turkish flags on the sides of schools and hospitals in this part of Syria overnight. Now, this is very interesting to me. We're going to take about a 1 minute breather. We're going to come back. We're going to get into your questions. We have a great line of questions already here. This is going to be an excellent coming up. Maybe we'll go until we get the best questions answered. So yeah, 30 seconds, a minute, maybe 2 minutes. We'll be right back. All right, and we are back. You know, very interesting. A couple of things that were sort of already said have been said again. They've been reiterated. Shoigu spoke to the Central Command, and he says, any foreign weapons, including U.S. weapons, any transport of them that goes into the territory of Ukraine, once it is in Ukraine, that is when it becomes a legitimate target. Does that make sense? Now, the question that you would want to ask yourself if you were Russia was, or would be, do you want to deal, how do you want to deal with Poland? Does Poland go in? And what is the Russian attitude towards that? That's what we've been talking about a lot today because it keeps coming up. And it comes up as Russian caliber strikes on strategic positions in Western Ukraine continue. I won't even say escalate, but just, you know, because they're adding. As it escalates over time, just by virtue of continuing consistently, as the damage toll increases, we should say rather, is that our little formula? Is that what tells us that we're going to be hearing more and more about what Poland wants to do or thinks it's going to do in Ukraine? Now, they would be crazy to think that if they do it, they would be crazy to think that they're doing it would come with Russian opposition, but they might couch it that way. And we might interpret it that way. It might seem to us that that's what's being said, even if it's not. And for its part, if Russia didn't want to do anything about it, it might vocalize that somehow. It just depends on how the media information game would be played. Does Poland need doing what they're going to do if they do it, right, in Ukraine? Does that need to be a move against Russia? I mean, I think they have to say that on a certain level, right? But is that really what people are going to think in the country? But the Ukrainian losses are not sustainable. Sending in more weapons, even though I suppose they're just going to keep getting hit in these precision strikes. But sending in more weapons can certainly serve to destabilize more regions or create more possibility of weapons flows from different parts of the world, into different parts of the world, rather, into different parts of the world. But that's not to say that it makes the situation in Ukraine much more difficult for the Russian campaign to manage, when you consider the amount of training and people with experience that are being taken out, a lot of Ukraine is losing a lot of, there are a lot of people that can't just be replaced with, you know, you need commanders, you need field commanders, you need people on the ground that know how to run a war, how to conduct a conflict. It's not just everyone is just a recruit. They're losing important people, and you can't just bring people in off the street to do this overnight, can you? No, you can't. So if they're going to continue to attempt to field armies, you're going to see, I think, a dangerous and unfortunate spike in the numbers of Ukrainian military casualties. Also, their range of motion is greatly limited now without as much access to fuel and lubricants. It's going to be a problem. Their ability to move around these things in the country has been greatly limited. Now, people talk about, well, they can, it will just take them 3 weeks to rebuild this bridge, or they can rebuild this bridge in 2 months and it's only going to cost X and X. That's not the point. They need these bridges yesterday. they don't need a bridge that works in 2 months. There's going to be another minimally 45 to 50,000 dead Ukrainian soldiers by the time these bridges are rebuilt. And what it gets limited from being brought in, at what rate and what volume and how long it takes, is everything. That's what all this logistics talk is all about. And we also, again, I have to play my own press agent, I suppose. It was right here on this, whatever you want to call this, non-show of a show, that we said that what's super important isn't what your first army looks like, but what your second and your third army look like as you're, you know, raising new armies. Ukraine is already raising new armies. They did this in the 8 years ago too. I remember the so-called second mobilization and the third mobilization. None of that stopped the meat grinder. In fact, it contributed to it. The quality of the recruits goes down. Not because they took all the best material or something to begin with out of the population. No, it's about the technique, the time, and the people that have experience, that have longer careers. And there's a lot of relatively competent people as like field commanders and captains. It's a military. It's not just one guy giving orders and everyone in the field follows the orders. There's a lot of experience needed in the field. You can't just do a draft. This is a huge nightmare situation that Ukrainian forces are in. If you paid attention to nothing, none of the drama, none of the Poland, West Ukraine stuff, none of the Moldova, you know, force NATO, Moldova, Transnistria, all of these potential side dramas. Imagine you're watching a movie like Game of Thrones or something. And there's all this talk about some potential conflict and some potential battle and this potential move and what happened at this meeting. And there's a lot invested into narratives and hypothesizing and guessing and if I was a fly on a room, you know, on the wall in that room and so on, what's really going to happen with Poland? What are they really, you know, do Russia and Poland have some secret deal, so secret that they don't even know they have it, right? Do they have some deal over West Ukraine or what? How will they deal with the how will Poland deal with the Banderites? Okay. All of that is drama. Oh, is Scholz going to buckle? Did he buckle? How many weapons? Is Germany supplying heavy? These are like themes. Is Germany going to supply heavy weapons? It becomes like these keywords, these media words. So how are you going to define heavy weapons? Well, can we get the media to say that I sent heavy weapons if we sent them these old? I mean, they weigh a lot. They're heavy. I mean, they weigh a lot. Scholz is telling his people, you know, can we get the media to call this heavy weapons? Well, sir, yes, but they're very old. They're just basically going to be target practice, sitting ducks is the expression. Yes, but if we send them in, can we say we sent in something heavy? Well, yes. Okay. Then do that. Send those in. Okay. All of that is drama. All of that is drama. Think about the conflict in the military in the physical sense. Has there been any talk of Ukrainian counteroffensive? Just a real on the ground. Are the Ukrainians mounting a counteroffensive? What's their fucking plan? Really? No, I mean, I really want to know. What are they saying they're going to do? Because I haven't seen anything. All of their efforts have been focused on, well, if you read the telegram of the Rada, it's just about the work of government. And they continue on observing like the holidays and the state. Today is, you know, national pick up a piece of trash day. I mean, they have, you know, like the normal things, right? They're trying to maintain the semblance like they have a country with institutions, even though their country got a lot smaller and poorer rapidly. They still go through that now. And then the military channels and the news, the media, they're focusing on war crimes. They're focusing on war crimes from Russia, crimes against humanity conducted by the Russians. This is all over the Radio Free, Radio Liberty, you know, Voice of America, Radio Liberty in the Ukrainian language, all over YouTube. And they talk about sanctions, Western support, bad Putin, bad Russia. But where are the military, like where is their push? Where's their push? As promised, we were going to come back and hit the some questions. Dear Mr. Flores, please share your thoughts on the Russian clip on nuking UK. Highly disturbing. I think we mentioned this one. Yes, it was just a documentary on like Russia 24 or something like that. And it just was talking about various Russian capabilities. And it just so happens that they do have this, that Russia does apparently have this ability to destroy the UK in about 20 minutes and actually put the whole island underwater. But that's a nuclear option. And obviously not anyone's intention, or I shouldn't say anyone, but so a funny little diplomatic row has escalated between Israel and Russia when Lavrov was answering how it could be that Ukraine is like a Nazi friendly state when Zelensky is Jewish, and Lavrov responds that, isn't Hitler part Jewish? Isn't he? I thought I remember that too. Is that correct or is that not correct? Was the name Shekel Grubber? It's a funny name too. Shekel, like grubbing, like a Shekel Grubber. Can you imagine if that was your name? Shekel Grubber? Like if that was your actual name and then like you got made fun of, people said you were Jewish maybe when you were a kid. I mean, your name is Shekel Grubber. I mean, come on. Is that like someone who hoards or eats shekels? Like collects them or, yes, hoards them? Shekel Grubber? And then he changed his name to Hitler. Question, turning the page. In Poland, they're trying to pass new legislation which would force nearly all women to serve in the military. Exception is really pregnant and a few others, but not many. At the same time, President says he hopes soon Ukraine and Poland will be one land, one union. Yes, it maybe will be a Polish, Ukrainian-Polish Commonwealth. Yes, maybe. It certainly would be, it would mean that Poland was really in charge, I think. I think that would be very hard for, it would raise a lot of questions. It's sort of like, what are we going to do from the perspective of all of these are just, not just, but that the U.S. has considerable control. First of all, the fact that for some time in the beginning of the war, when the government fled from Kiev to Lviv, then they then went to Warsaw, right? And we've had continual confirmation, not just like a confirmation bias confirmation of our theory. I think it's reasonable, by the way, to assume or to conclude now that Zelensky has returned to Kiev, like had since pretty much when the withdrawal happened. So then when you look at Zelensky's now being in his office, but you've continually heard about the military command. You heard from, who was it? I think Reshetnikov, retired foreign intelligence service, said that the victories, the battlefield victories from use of high precision artillery from the Ukrainian side were being coordinated, or the effective strikes, I don't know if they were always led to victories, but the effective strikes on the Ukrainian side were being coordinated from Warsaw, from Poland. So, but that was NATO. So this is not the same thing as Poland becoming like a more powerful super state or whatever, but it, what I'm talking about is that it can be seen by people who are Poles as that, and it can lead to such thinking among Polish leadership. And that's why we talked about the big flex in the millennia coming out of the, you know, in post-World War II, countries' borders weren't supposed to change. But then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, some borders did change again, not just the borders of the Soviet Union, but borders of other countries in Europe. And that had an influence. Our thinking, however, has by and large been that borders have been stable since World War II. There hasn't been another war like a World War III, right, to destabilize things. And that the changes that occurred the border changes that occurred, like say with Czechoslovakia becoming Czech Republic and Slovakia and just onward and so on like this, or Yugoslavia, these were seen as local. Some these just were non-events, like Czechoslovakia, non-event, or they had conflict, even a lot of fighting wars, like in Yugoslavia in the 90s. But then we return to this, okay, but these are the borders, and now this is, okay, the euro was launched in 99. Okay, this is the new, now we have stability. Okay. But it's not really the case. Stability is not really the norm in such a fast-changing world. And the thinking about the changing of the shape of the landscape in Europe has gone through iterating things in terms of international law, but then introduced with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Yugoslavia, these expressions that have been put as if they were interchangeable or even superseded international law, called a rules-based order. And we talked about that at great length. So Poland, to acquire territory somehow, number one, you're not talking overnight. Number two, there's also talks about what to do with the Ukrainian elite who are there's a lot of ways of keeping people trapped in their position. A lot of these oligarchs, billionaires are often controlled by these intelligence services, and there's just too many mechanisms that keep you invested in the things that you're invested in. You would think not. You would think it's your money. Money doesn't work. The more money that you have, even though there's like this status people think you have, like you, there's less ways that you can, there's less things you can do with a lot of money, if that makes sense. You can have your personal projects, but you can't just disinvest without people trying to kill you, or, you know, you can get sued. Someone can find some cause to sue you, and then the courts are lined up against you because they're trying to keep you from making moves. A lot of these oligarchs are controlled. So to the extent that they want to solve Ukraine or create any part of it out of the Western Ukrainian oligarchs that can't, or the Ukrainian oligarchs that can't integrate into Russian vectors in any way, if that's a, you know, that's not what we're talking about. And building up enough support with overly invested, like in the West, these Ukrainian oligarchs to do something. What kind of state or rump state will they have, and how will they keep it together? Will it require, basically, they've lost the state, they've lost the army, right? I mean, if they don't have enough of a military, it's as if the longer they're out in the field losing their military, the more it seems like Poland just wants to just send their army into Ukraine, into Western Ukraine. Whereas if you knew you were going to lose all this stuff, you would basically try to sue for peace, create a line on the Dnieper, and recognize everything that they've taken, and hold on to Mykolaiv and Odessa, and that's it. Sign the peace treaty at this point. Maybe you could get Kherson back today, but I think that window closed 2 weeks ago. I think, and these have been all rational choice tests on the sovereignty of Ukraine coming from Russia. The more ridiculous, the more unable that Ukraine is able not able to make a deal, the more that Ukraine came to the table and was unable to deal with reality with their body language and their posture, this just, the more that that happened, the less that there was any chance that Ukraine was ever going to exist. So if they have a commitment to actually not come away from this conflict with a force that can even defend a small new country that might not even include Kiev. I mean, maybe Kiev is the westernmost city and the cap and remains the capital of some new country. But at this point, I don't see the Russians winding up their operation. I don't see them going home. I haven't seen their casualty numbers in a while, but I would say they're at about a quarter. I would just pin them or mark them now at it being at about a quarter of the 50,000 of the Ukrainian losses. Turning the page. So this is how I look at these questions, but we're going to turn the page. Question. Do you think Russia will take Odessa, and would Ukraine still function if it gets landlocked? I think the rhythm and flow of this conflict, that Russia would want to take Odessa. I think that it has to keep turning their rejection of, there's like conversation going on, okay? There's a crime or a claim that's made, a claim of a crime or a great catastrophe or a false flag or something that is claimed by the Ukrainian side, which shifts our focus in the information war as people looking at what's going on, and we all focus on this when all of these, it doesn't really matter to Russia, these things, except that at a certain point, they were being staged or used to justify or to force the hand of further European intervention. And I think that while there has been, of course, some token responses in the aftermath of it, I think the key word there is token. And I think that Europe's whole approach to this conflict has been more token than not. They've come at it half-hearted. They already know what's going on. And Ukraine can still exist as a landlocked country. There's no reason why it has to be the Ukraine. I mean, it still can be a fairly large country if you look at a map. It could, you know, in terms of its square kilometers, it could still be fairly decent in population. It still functions as a country. It has the resources, service economy, you know, basically everyone washing each other's clothes and selling each other things at the, you know, pharmacy or whatever. I mean, it's just like at the drugstore, it's a grocery store. There's, you know, money can change hands through Ukraine, people doing all the different services for each other. Something has to get produced. So, yes, it can function. What I really think is the unspoken part of this is that when we look at Ukrainian strategic thinking has been happening on two different levels. There's been the level of we're fighting a war and we want this money and weapons and support for a war. But you have another level of a realization that you can't win a war with Russia over Ukraine. There was a realization that Ukraine was eventually going to go into the Russian sphere within a period of a decade. It has to. There's just a gravity of the economic interactions and where people go and how things are sold and bought and the geographic proximity in the energy markets, that by 2035, Ukraine is effectively rejoined with Russia. Just even everything being the same, except for the part of Ukraine attacking, right? Like Ukraine attacking Donbass or trying to go forward and seize Rostov and take that whole, you know, if they thought they could do that or something, and then call a ceasefire or retake Crimea or something, whatever they thought they could do before that. Okay. Even with the conflict, just even during Minsk II and what was going on, just through the normal years, like if the status quo of 2017, 2016, if you go forward with that 15 years, 20 years from there, Ukraine is part of Russia. So there's a certain thinking among Ukrainian elites, the oligarchs, that let's shake, just Ukraine's going to get taken by Russia either way. If Russia has to bleed for it, that means that's a cost that is being, you know, registered onto Russia. And we're going to be the middlemen of that cost. They don't think they are going to win. And they know that Ukraine goes to Russia. The cabal is happy if the Ukraine that goes to Russia needs to be reconstructed, because that makes it less valuable. But there's natural resources and population there that, and history of locations and people know about places on the map, will be rebuilt. And people will go there and live and work. But it will be a cost to rebuild it. And on top of the cost of the war itself. And having encumbered all of these costs is supposed to hurt the Russian position. And if not hurt them, at least this allows the gears of NATO to turn and its mechanisms, and for people to do their jobs and to get their budgets, and for this fictional economy to allocate inflated, you know, or inflationary debased currencies towards a war machine effort that is half-hearted and not meant to create a military victory, but as a way to maximize incomes out of an inevitability. That's what's really going on in Ukraine. No one in the leadership thinks that they win this war. They don't think they hold on to the territory. They don't know. They're looking at how they can integrate into a Polish national oligarchy, maybe, is one, what people, word on the street sort of thing. But who knows? We talked about that, how that would be a big move for Poland to do. But none of those things matter. You're, as Ukrainian oligarchs, you're taking all this unmarked, this is just payday, and you're just managing and laundering, you're stealing these weapons and things that come in, and you're the one that's redirecting the sale on the ground. There could be tacit coordination with Russia through this whole process to prolong it. Maybe demilitarization And denazification also works in the interest of Ukrainian oligarchs. Just because it's a thing that happens and it prolongs the conflict. Maybe Russia's prolonging the conflict as well, or understanding that the tactic of prolonging the conflict is one that's going to be attempted to be imposed by the opponent. So how to make it work, how to make that work for them. How to make that work for them, right? So there's so many potential angles. I mean, don't think in terms of this country's against that country or whatever. Just think about all these freewheeling agents and actors and stuff, and they just do what makes sense in their own, how are they in their own networks, their power networks, what they're allowed to do, what they could do, what they can do. Can they coordinate that? You know, how could that conflict be engineered? How can the battlefield be shaped to create an illusion of a conflict that's going a certain way or that just requires certain things? And and Ukrainian elites are denazifying. They're rinsing their hands of this group that was built up. It just, the problem had to go somewhere. This was like this stupid, bizarre West Ukrainian identity political crisis that was a very, just a sort of a, a West Ukrainian identity that was being, we've talked about this so much, we don't need to reiterate, but just how it was built up through USAID and the Gladio B and all of this, and how it was set up and maintained and subsidized and financed as an important project for decades and decades and decades, all the connections to Canada, the expatriate, Ukrainian expatriate community in Canada, very large, all of them, you know, Banderites, OUM, OUMB, et cetera. So how this had to just, it had to lead to this now. And this is just, it's a stupid nightmare narrative that took over Ukraine. And Ukrainian oligarchs are not like true believers in anything. Like, they just see ideology. They're not Banderites. They made a lot of money in that system, but it led to this, and that system is over. If Poland is really going to be part of co-managing a rump Ukrainian state, that rump Ukrainian state seems that it would need to be denazified by Poland. And it seems that only Poland can really integrate. And frankly, at this point, it's very, stupid from the point of view of Ukraine. But do you imagine Ukraine and Poland having a union state, and imagine that Poland is the stronger state just because it has existing institutions? And I mean, can you just imagine that? Imagine also just the whole Bandera, the whole thinking of Ukrainian nationalism. Oh, sure, there's been this or that battle in the 17th century or the 19th century, and allied with Poland or allied against Poland or allied with Sweden or allied against Russia or whatever. But none of those things guarantee that you're going to have a modern state. And this is the moment that we are in now. This is where the whole game brought it to. Just think about that calamity. Think about that disaster that has been Ukraine. Again, we're not thinking about the daily information war stuff. Just look at the situation on the ground. Russia is winning battles, not losing battles. There are more regions going over, not less. The Ukraine's ability is being eroded. They're losing 300 to 500 people a day in the field. That's unsustainable for Ukraine. They can't show any victories. And there's like serious talk, like, can we somehow make something happen with Russia, or is this a Poland thing? What's their sense of things? It's insane. Does Russia have something better to offer than Poland to Ukraine, to what's left of Ukraine? Is Poland left with the task of denazifying? Would Ukraine allow that? And when we say, would Ukraine allow that, we're talking a complex animal. Voters would not allow that. Oligarchs don't give a rat's butt. Whatever works for them is what works. They're not worried about the national idea. Arestovich and Zelensky, that whole milieu, they know that Ukraine is not a winnable project. It's just, how do you make all the money? There are people that want to make the inevitable, as Russia's economy grows. So just, you know, you go back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, da 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 da. Okay, as its political institutions become more solvent, as its economy grows, all of the sanctions and all of the stuff started to be heaped upon Russia. It was given a couple of strange things happened, of course, in the past 8 years. There was a few fuel price jumps, which helped them. Whenever the, you know, Brent crude barrel goes over 70 or 80, that was good for them. It had to be, right? At 100, it's great for them. Has to be, right? But when you look at the entire thing, the whole story, the Atlantis' powers could not create a prosperous nation state called Ukraine. It couldn't create one with working institutions. It worked directly through an oligarchy, and there was no central authority in the state. There was no state institution that was not corrupt. In the police, the state police, the secret police were all corrupt. How did that happen? The coup against Yanukovych. Who gave the orders to shoot at protesters? Someone had the authority, but it wasn't Yanukovych. And it was that authority who had contact with Noland. So you don't have sovereign. So, you know, if you had a sovereign intelligence service, that meeting that person had with Nolan would have been known about. They should have been arrested for that, or detained and questioned, and everything recorded from that, monitored. It was known that he was going to give an order to shoot at protesters. And that's not at all how Yanukovych, or how anyone would recommend, you know, dealing with a color revolution that was fizzling out. It was about to fail. That's why they did the shooting. People were going home. It was a provocation. And while all these little tactics and games can work to give you control over the political institutions of a state, if you don't have functioning rule of law, transparency, if your state institutions are not stronger than the oligarchy, that can work at the center of an empire for some time, as the empire probably hemorrhages and very inefficient and everything like that. But at least the central power is reinforced, because that's the central power that's used to rule other parts of the world. So the cabal, you can have an oligarchy more powerful than the state or the intelligence services when you are the ones investing in possessing that power from which your power is gained. But when it comes to a satellite or a proxy or a neo-colony like Ukraine, you cannot have the oligarchy. The plutocracy cannot be the oligarchy, if that makes sense. An oligarchy cannot rule in the place of state institutions and a security service. They have to be, if you're called a country and you have rules and you have laws and it's in the Constitution, it's in your codes about that you're a sovereign state and what's considered treason or what's considered collusion or selling off the country or whatever these things, however it's termed, you need a sovereign intelligence agency that's committed to preserving those things. Now, you can get away with not having that if you're an empire, because you can be on autopilot, cruise control for some time. And like we said, power institutions will form around that plutocracy in the center, in the core of the empire. But you can't, it can only, that can only happen, if that's happening in a country like Ukraine, that's because the resources are being stripped. They're being pulled out of the geography. Like, you need to have a strong state institutions and a sovereign intelligence. Think about it, because let's say you have entrepreneurship, you have private businesses, but if they're owned by foreigners, or if you don't have capital controls about where investment and tax, how taxes and investment work, for example, if you're not taxed on reinvestment into Ukraine, but you're taxed on monies that you invested outside of Ukraine, things like that. That's how you maintain sovereign control and use public co-private institutions in harmony to create, governance and synergy, corporate synergy at the national level. If anyone like a police chief is meeting with a foreign State Department employee to talk about how they're going to handle security of a protest, that's treason. So Ukraine was already handed over to the Obama administration. They lost their sovereignty through a bunch of individuals just acting in their what they perceive their own interests to be. But people only act in what they perceive their own interests to be, and how they define those interests and what they see as those interests are value judgments. They're socially created. So after a long period of soft power operating on a country, you still have individuals operating in their own self-interest, but it's soft power on Ukraine is when Ukrainian oligarchs saw that it was better to have more stable investments outside of Ukraine into the Western, maybe the stock markets or real estate, wherever they were invested, not in Ukraine. That's soft power. So this is a very curious thing. No one in Ukraine thinks that they're going to win. No one in the leadership thinks. I mean, no one of this thinking. I know it's circular. Now, there are people whose job it is at some functionary level, of course. You know, the ministry of this and that. They think, we're not talking about government ministers or, even people in the military. I think the military has a very sneaking suspicion that they're not, that the people in charge are not trying to win. There is, this military is on the verge of total collapse, mutiny, surrender, switching sides. There is a very many interesting things that could go on. Could you imagine if huge switching sides occurs of military in the Donbas? That seems to be a thing that could happen. I would expect that they're loaded down with a lot of food and that they're fine, but not for long. But the morale, you know, the culture of a military corporation, institution, the culture is felt by the people who deal in that institution on a daily basis. And you can, you can tell if the resources aren't getting to you. You know, when you put in a request, how long it takes to be filled, or what type of answers you're getting, or what the commitment level has been so far on delivery on commitments. What has the delivery been on those commitments? By this time, 60, 70 days into a conflict, and you are already having these problems, it's done. The oligarchs and the people around Zelensky, Arestovich, they know that this is not winnable. They know that this is about Ukraine is defeated. They hate being Ukrainian. Let me explain what this is like. It's humiliating that in your attempts to be a sovereign state, that your political class has not managed economic sovereignty, but has defined sovereignty as starting a fucking war with Russia. Can you imagine that catastrophe, like that nightmare? And imagine the types of psychopaths that, simply to line their own pockets as the middlemen of death, as the middlemen of giving Russia a bloody nose, while Russia assumes control of a region that it was going to assume control of later, if not sooner, very peacefully, talking all of Ukraine, by what we were talking about. Even Arestovich said this in 2019 or 2018 when he was saying, yeah, there'll be a war like in 1 to 2, 3 years. Because of the way things are going, they knew what the red lines were. It wasn't magical. He wasn't looking at a crystal ball or have magical powers. This is just, this is what they were being told. The Russians had a red line. They knew what it was. They were being built up. There was a scam that England was running with the U.S. that they were convincing. They were trying to be convincing among enough of a certain layer of some of Ukrainians' military authorities, not the oligarchs who knew nothing could actually win, because they knew what the scam was with the money and the military industrial complex and the contracts and the weapons coming through. But they created enough of a simulacrum for some of the military authorities in Ukraine to really believe that by doing this thing, by kinking the numbers of reserves, by imagining that they had 900,000 reserves when they maybe had 100,000 at most that had 2 weeks of basic training, that by lying about these numbers and by pumping it in, that they were going to inflate. It's like when you're going to get a turkey and it's got to be a certain weight, and they just like stick the needle in and pump the oil in to the turkey to plump it up. That's what they did to the Ukrainian military over the past, like since Biden has been in there. They just boom, boom, they just pumped it up. They changed the laws about what it's considered, or they changed the wording of the code or the implementation procedure on what's considered to be a reserve, so they could put on paper that they had an army almost the size of Russia. That's crazy to do that to your own people. These people are psychopaths. They knew that it was going to cost tens of thousands of soldiers or human beings. That part is true. Not when they're trapped, when they can surrender, then it's like very, very manipulative to say, hey, soldiers are people. They're just human soldiers. Innocent soldiers are trapped in the mines in Azovstal, the mine collapsed. It was an act of God. It was just a natural calamity. We have to free the trapped soldiers. They're singing Kumbaya, my Lord. You know, they're trapped under there, running out of air. We got to bring in the international community to free the innocent soldiers. But broadly on the field, these are just people don't want to be there. And I was like, soldiers are not like politicians. And they're not like dumb voters. Dumb voters believe the politicians, and then they believe that the soldiers are all very idealistic and patriotic and out there doing this duty. They're just like in this draft nightmare. They didn't have $1,500 to buy themselves out of the draft. See, 8 years ago, it only cost me $400 or $500 to get out of the draft in Ukraine. It's gone up quite a bit, like three times. It's like tripled. Stakes are really high. Look at these guys. They don't want to be there. They're on a death march. They've received a death sentence so that people who are already rich, who are just addicted to money, who have like a mental, some satanic, whatever possession that they're experiencing in life, they have a addiction to money, and they're going to send a lot of people to die, and call them soldiers, that give them whatever, moldy bread, maggoty rice, send them out into the field without equipment, without, you know, good vests and stuff. I mean, you die anyway, but I mean, it's like not even pretending to care. They're not even pretending to care. Just totally sick. I mean, Russia won this war before it started. McGregor said it. Flynn said it. Anyone with their fucking brain functioning can look at this conflict, and it's just awful. Subjecting a population to it, occupying towns that you can't hold, putting your defense systems in between civilian buildings, not letting people leave, using human shields. That's to destroy Ukraine. That's hurting the Ukrainian population. It's hurting people. It's hurting the infrastructure. All of that is to make it as costly as possible, the inevitable thing that Russia takes Ukraine. And it was just whether it was going to be militarily or economically. And economically, it would have taken a little bit longer. Militarily, it goes like this. And this is basically the Ukrainian oligarchs. This is their final cash parade. This is the money, the money rain, the money dance, whatever this is, the parade, like the confetti, money confetti spraying down on their little victory parade of money, cash money. But the actual military conflict is supposed to lose. That's what I think. And now they're just like, okay, can we put our money together? These are like the Ukrainian oligarchs. And can we, you know, all agree to buy this telecom company that operates out of Lviv? Or can we, what's this? Is there a Polish company for sale? Like a big one? Like what if Poland's second largest company got co-owned like 60% of controlling shares or something by Kolomoisky and these guys, all these guys? I mean, what you see what I'm saying? Now they have it. Whatever they shook down from this money that goes into Ukraine. And they hate these NATO deals. Because when the NATO says we're giving you, here's $30 billion, and they say it in the press, and everyone's like, yeah, okay, $30 billion, great. Okay, now they have $30 billion. Now Ukraine's like, okay, we got $30 billion coming in, but then they don't have it in. They don't have the money. It's like, it's like a Girl Scout cookie catalog. Imagine you have like $20 credit with the Girl Scout for Girl Scout cookies. But then you look at the boxes and like, yo, each box of cookies is like $8. These are like $3 at the store. These are like $10 a box. So what the Biden administration has done with Ukraine is provide them a Girl Scout cookie, whatever that's called, menu, list, inventory, and they get to pick $30 billion worth of stuff that only has a street value of like maybe like realistically what's comparable to other countries and what would other countries spend to produce the comparable thing, because they do and they exist and these are the numbers. It's like $2 billion or $3 billion. Only an idiot, I mean, like Riley Wagaman, for example, would compare that to the what Russia gets out of $60 billion is like 10 to 20 times more. It's like spending $600 billion or $1.2 trillion. It's just irrelevant to talk about. You should just talk about the number of pieces and what. Do they know how to use them? What's the number of pieces and what's the type of piece? Is it fourth generation, third generation, fifth generation? What type of piece is it? What does it do? How good is it? How many do they have? Do they know how to use it with other pieces? Can they, you know, what do the war games say? You don't look at the military budget. It doesn't tell you anything. That's all. There's too many things like purchasing power parity and, you know, where does your dollars come from? I mean, if it takes $2 of debt to produce $1 of GDP growth on paper, and you have debt-driven GDP growth, and the debt-to-GDP ratio is on planet crazy, then you try to convert that into claiming how much you're buying with those inflated dollars, those debased dollars, whatever they are. You're buying material like F-35s, like take a hike. You're not doing anything with that. The American military doctrine is not, has not been, was not ever to be able to win a war in Eurasia, like a conventional war in Eurasia. No. No. It's a terrible crime. It's a terrible racket, this war. It's really more of a disturbing look into the human condition, you know, things that we're capable of. We, you know, collectively, humanity, could you ever do that? But you have to understand how addiction works. It's interesting how just broadly how money and power addiction is not talked about. Like, and we don't talk about that. And then we have this strange word that we use for abusive people. We call them narcissists when that's not accurate. Sorry to digress a little bit, but just, we're just trying to understand, like, just think about Ukraine, the oligarch, the political, you know, whatever, the economic elite. They've got to have the same ideology as George Soros, who, when questioned, I don't know if it was on 60 Minutes or whatever, it looked like Charlie Rose, but it was the other guy who sounds just like Charlie Rose. We shared it on here a few months ago when the conflict started, just so people could know who Soros was. He's an unrepentant Nazi collaborator. He said in this interview he has no remorse at all about helping the Nazis. And the guy asked him, even though you're Jewish, he's like, no, it's like, you know, better them than me, and better them than me, and I would never want it to be me. But it, you know, he's like, well, I suppose it could have been me, but the point is that it wasn't. It wasn't me, and also doing it, I didn't do it. And if it wasn't, no, he said, if it wasn't me, it would have been someone else. And therefore, it wasn't me. Like, yeah, follow that one. So that's like the thinking. Hey, if it wasn't Kolomoisky himself, there would have been some other Kolomoisky there. And he knows because he's there swimming with sharks and he sees the people that would take what Kolomoisky has if Kolomoisky didn't have it himself. And if he's the one in the position to do these things. And if he wasn't, it would be Akhmatov. And sometimes it is Akhmatov or any of these other people. Even Medvedchuk. All of these people have had their different rides on the merry-go-round of looting Ukraine. The entire, you know, it doesn't matter what you believe. The entire state, the modern society of Ukraine was built up under communism. So remember, this was before the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And they were trying, so states were still competing at building up this thing. They used to call it societies. Society, you send children to school, they read, people go to work in factories, work in bureaucracies. They work 8-10 hours a day, 5 days. It was this thing called society that we had. And the Soviet Union was doing it very well. And setting aside whatever other, what we might try to bring into the discussion, or if you're an entrepreneur or religious, I mean, these are important questions. But in terms of the big industries and the massive wealth that was built up in Ukraine, this was all built up in the communist period. And just the last 30 years has been this looting, just basically whatever took 70 years to build up has been taken 30 years to build down. Let's just say like that. It took 30 years to kind of loot it all out. I mean, there's enough that you kick back into the system and keep it going and stuff, but there was nothing really truly new or innovative that was sovereign. What we got were number one human trafficking, number one biological weapons, number one sex trade, organ trade, you know, awful things, prostitution, number one in the world, all in Ukraine. Amazing. It's amazing what happens . You know, like when people say, oh, you know, it's people who can run a country like they run a business would do very well. No, not if pump and dump is your business. No, not if you just invest into things to sell it. Because who do you sell a country to once you've taken it from the people, from its owners? You can't sell it back to the countries. You're selling it to foreigners. You're selling it to foreign interests. Now, if everyone just took some kind of hit, or their taxes went up 10% because of that, or inflation doubled and all, oh, it sucks and stuff, but you still had hospitals and grandma could still get her heart surgery and maybe we just have less vacation time. I mean, all these things are tolerable. They're wrong. It's not social justice. People should fight against it, but it's tolerable. But imagine that now the game plan after building up this fake Nazi shit, like Zelensky, none of these people believed it. Kolomoisky, Zelensky, none of these people believe any of this stuff. They're like, this is the consumption. This is the culture. They hate it. Like, they hate being with the Ukrainian deplorables. And it's sad. It's a sad situation that they're in. Like, they're only like monster trucks and Nazis. Spam. Or that whatever that canned, overprocessed canned meat stuff, we call it spam. Hating being identified accidentally as a Russian by Germans, so you get a fucking swastika tattoo on your fucking forehead. And we talked about it just like in romantic relationships. Why would Ukraine prove, how can they prove that they're European by dying when the definition of a European is that Europeans don't let Europeans die? And, you know, we talked about the class dimensions and of course world wars don't work out that way. But the whole mythology of Western Europe and human rights and everything is that they wouldn't create this kind of situation for Ukrainians if Europe really believed that Ukrainians were European. The things that the amount of self-harm that Ukraine is doing for to get the love and approval of Europe is more telling that this is a Europe that doesn't deserve your love, Ukraine. And Ukrainians know that the politicians are lying, and they know that the oligarchs are selling the country out. And the only people that were allowed to have the space to have credibility to attack both the Europhile politicians with their hypocrisy about elections that are always run, in fact, by the oligarchs, or all the only people that were allowed by the same problem, reaction, solution, controlled political paradigm fight game set up by the Atlanticists, the only possible third position or alternative to a corrupt oligarchy selling the country out and a stupid political class talking about how we're all going to get prosperous if we join the EU, the only solution to that that was allowed by the same people that was to be a fucking Nazi. And not just a few of them, but it's like the default, like people's bumper stickers on their cars and stuff, and these stupid little sneering expressions and these little thought-terminating one-liners, these cliches, thought-terminating cliches. These little phrases that end all conversation. Well, better this than Russian. Well, maybe not. Maybe better Russian than this. Maybe not what you just said, dude. Maybe the opposite of the thing that you just said. Oh, man. What a nightmare. What a nightmare for Ukraine. It's a beautiful country. You've seen it enough to know by now. So much potential, and it will be realized. It just couldn't happen. It just the experiment of Ukraine existing as a modern state, given its potential wealth, its location, its resources, its people, its history, the temporary dip in Russian power, like this is, you know, all international relations that we're talking about. This is all balance of power. Just look what happens when you get these imbalances that arise in global power balance. Like, I don't want Russia to be a great power in Minnesota or in California or in Mexico. Don't misinterpret, you know, what my angle is here. That would create further disbalances, and other people would be harmed or put in harm's way. But instead of just taking a reasonable approach to Ukraine, actually very similar to the economic end of the EU, the industrial end of the EU has been very responsible, very similar to Russia. All of this attacks on European countries and even Germany for not going all in. They actually understand much of this. There's a political class in power, and it's more connected to banking and transatlanticism. And that post-World War II relationship between Europe and the U.S., between Western Europe and the U.S. But aside from that, there's a reality check. And again, that's why Victoria Nuland, in those recorded private conversations, was caught saying fuck the EU, because they know that this doesn't work for the EU. They know that the EU does not do well in a destabilized Ukraine. The EU was fine with, they liked the Party of Regions. They liked Yanukovych. The Russians liked them. Now, Ukraine had these endemic problems that we talked about, and that made that moment in time unstable. But politically, that could have been very stable. Again, without constructing counterfactual histories, that could have been very stable. And it might have been very stable. And the Obama administration, the cabal, destabilized it. Now, the sickness of our time, the sickness in our hearts of greed in this yuga, greed and the dynamics and the lack of value placed on human life, or the ability to look the other way, that these people can do that is very sad, and a very sad commentary on the human. It shows us that we're all capable of this on a certain level. And you don't know what you're capable of unless you are in the position to do it. And then you often disappoint yourself. Given that these are predictable ways that things go down when societies collapse, think about how important it is to keep societies going. At least that are stable and basically just, or survivable. Fairness is a cream on top, but you can see what happens when things destabilize. Nobody thought that Ukraine wins this. All the other intrigues are very interesting. Who stuck at Azovstal? Who got out? What was that all about? We saw the UN people there. We saw I saw a couple of women leave one of the buses that looked a little interesting to me. I thought that looked kind of like not someone that had been, or what was her status or position there? Why was she with couple of very interesting looking people that stood out to me. And the war will be filled with these kinds of things on a daily basis. These little interesting stories and intrigues and the truths coming out about what Ukraine had developed, planned, or we say Ukraine, giving them the credit for it, but we just mean to designate these entities on the map, the cabal controlling Ukraine. But yes, you can see that in Ukraine, intelligent people, they know that the Nazi thing is stupid, but it's what manipulates, it's what works. It's part of the sauce. It's part of the Ukraine sauce at this time. And people are not like committed to it. They don't believe in it, except the people who are all wrapped up in it. And none of those people have power in Ukraine on a high level. It's just oligarchs that can't manage a country. And I mean, the Western cabal was running this whole Nazi cultural trope. All the politicians had to dance, but no individual had the power to go against it. everyone entering into politics as people entered, that was always just the lay of the land, and that was always just the name of the game. You didn't have to be into it or not into it. Didn't help to be against it if you want to have a future in Ukrainian politics or in the that whole anything that in that direction, society in general, academia, bureaucracy, whatever, not just elected office, but just being involved in the society at all. That was the game. Everyone had to pretend all the time that they're all in, and everyone's hedging their bets. Everyone is like, this ship is sinking. Everyone getting out of the country had been for years. It's not a new thing. We'll just close with the last question on Finland and Sweden. Croatian leader Milanovic is saying he would veto it if the process didn't go through the referendum process or through the whole. I think it has to go to the people to vote, and that's a very good thing. I think that that is a wrong process, that it's just by presidential decree or something like this or some vote at the upper house or some committee. That's not how you enter NATO. There's reasons we talked about this before. I said, you know, the kind of part of the attitude of the state and the people and the electorate is a little bit like part of their self-image is in they're not part of NATO, and they understand the risks and they understand the importance there. It's just a foolish move. These are just embarrassingly stupid, foolish moves from NATO. These are just trying to puff and posture while actually not having an alliance that they're not fighting for anything. No, nobody believes in anything. They don't really want to go through there's no belief. There's no belief over there. I think that's the real issue. They don't have resolve. Of course, they're not willing to die because they know they're not existentially threatened. They know that Russia is not an existential threat to them, and they know that they've been playing a game of putting Russia into a position where it could credibly present that they were existentially threatened and then make their moves. And no one believes in anything. And they know that Ukraine will go to Russia, however much of it is probably somehow related to something that Poland might do or not do, maybe. Whatever that looks like, seems that the plot has had it well introduced into that Poland is going to maybe do something. Okay, fine. That's it. So everything other than that is looking at this battle every day by the numbers. It's going very badly for Ukraine from what I can tell. And I try to look very much at a lot of Ukrainian media.
I'm looking at Ukrainian media. The thing that I see, again, just to wrap up the point, is not a lot of focus on the status of the conflict. but rather the status of the situation and more broad and general statements from leadership that they're in this to win this. And it's just, it's almost like the more they say it, the less that it's believed. That's my understanding of the situation. But yeah, that's been our show then for today. I'm going to save this. It'll be backed up. I'll get it up in a few minutes now. Have a great rest of the day. Take care.